They came in at last, moving with the slack, stumbling gait of a heavyweight boxer at the end of 10 hard rounds. Their tiger-striped camouflage was encrusted with the filth of the battlefield, and their faces were grey with exhaustion. While his men collapsed on the floor of the amphitheatre and slept where they fell, Alfonso described to Sean, in flat, prosaic terms, the retreat from Grand Reef Base and the flight to the mission station in the gut of the Honda Valley, where they had abandoned the Unimog truck and crossed into Mozambique on foot. "The bush is full of Frelimo, and the air is full of Henshaw." He paused and wiped his face wearily on a grubby, tattered bandana. "It is witchcraft, but the Henshaw can speak from the sky. They taunt us in the Shangani language. They tell us that they have magic that turns our bullets and rockets to water." Sean nodded grimly. "The Russians must be using sky-shout amplifiers to demoralize the Renamo defenders." That was another trick they had learned in Afghanistan. "We all along the line our men are being shot to pieces, or are running away. We cannot fight against the Henshaw." "Yes, you bloody well can." Sean seized the front of his tunic. "I'll show you how. Get your men up. There'll be plenty of time to sleep later, when we've burned those Russian bastards out of the sky." Sean and Job had worked and fought with all these men, and had come to know them by name and deed, so they'd formed a fairly accurate picture of their individual worth and capabilities. They knew that there were no cowards nor shirkers amongst them. Alfonso had long ago sifted those out. However, there were those whom Job classified as oxen, the strong and stupid, the muscle and cannon fodder. The others were of varying degrees of intelligence and adaptability. At the top of the heap were Alfonso and Ferdinand. Sean and Job sorted them into two groups and concentrated their efforts on the most promising in each group, quickly picking out those who had the image recognition to translate what they saw on the aiming screen of the launchers into finite terms in shape and space. At the end of almost 3 hours, they had picked out 20 men who had the potential to assimilate swiftly the necessary training and to act as number ones in the missile teams, and as many again who might be able to fulfil the number two backup role. The others, who showed no aptitude, were allotted to the assault team, which would be using conventional weapons in the attack Sean was planning. Of the missile trainees, Sean took one group and Job the other, and they began the monotonous task of familiarising them with the actual weapons. Once again, they relied on the technique of repetition and reinforcement. Each trainee had his turn at stripping and reassembling, locking and loading, and aiming the launcher. While he did so, he explained to the class exactly what he was doing, and Sean and Job corrected their mistakes while the rest of the class taunted them. It was late afternoon before Sean sent the first group of 5 men, which included both Alfonso and Ferdinand, to Claudia for simulated attacks with the training equipment. Alfonso scored 3 consecutive hits and was immediately detailed to act as Claudia's assistant and translator. By nightfall, all 5 members of the first group had scored 3 consecutive hits, which Claudia had arbitrarily decided was her passing standard, and Sean and Job had another 10 men ready to begin simulator training as soon as it was sufficiently light the following morning. When it was too dark to continue, Sean dismissed them, and Alfonso and his group staggered off wearily into the night, punch-drunk with fatigue and the effort of learning. Joyful, the chef, had stolen the tripes from the buffalo carcass that had fed the officers' mess the previous evening. After the day's heat, they were a little ripe, but he'd disguised that fact with a liberal addition of chopped wild onion tubers and piri-piri sauce. Claudia paled when Joyful proudly placed a steaming bowl of the tripes in front of her. In the end, hunger overcame her fastidiousness. "Put air on your chest," Sean comforted her. "That, my darling man, isn't high on my list of beauty aids." "Okay, then," he smiled at her. "Put some weight on those skinny little buns of yours."
"You don't like my buns?"
I love your buns, and that's why I want more of them, as much as I can get. When Motatu came creeping in out of the darkness, Sean fed him, and he gorged on tripes until his naked belly bulged like a shiny black beach ball. All right, you greedy little bugger, Sean told him. Now it's time for you to earn your keep. They led him up to the dark amphitheatre where they found that Job was waiting for them. He had already assembled the raw materials for building the scale model of the gunship lager. By the light of two paraffin lanterns, they started to lay it out. Motatu had been a party to these model constructions so many times during the Bush War that he understood exactly what was required of him. Like so many who have never acquired the skill of reading and writing, Motatu had a photographic memory. He strutted about importantly, giving Sean and Job instructions, showing them the topography of the countryside, in and surrounding the lager, the shape of the hill on which it had been built, the relationship of it to the main road and the railway line. Claudia showed a new talent, which Sean had not suspected. Using the soft white wood of the baobab tree, she whittled 11 tiny scale models of the hind gunships. They were fully recognisable as what they represented, and when she sat them in their emplacements within the perimeter of the model lager, they added an authentic touch. It was well after midnight before Claudia and Sean crept naked under the mosquito net in their dugout. They were both weary to their bones, but even after they had made slow, languorous love, neither of them could sleep, and lay close in the darkness and talked. Mention of her father, earlier in the day, caused Claudia to hark back to her childhood. Listening to her, Sean was relieved that she was able to speak naturally and easily about her father. She had conquered the initial shock and sorrow, and she remembered him now with only a nostalgic melancholy, which was almost pleasure in comparison to the pain which had preceded it. She described to Sean how at the age of 14, the very year that her womanhood had first flowered, the wonderfully secure cocoon of her life had burst asunder in the traumatic divorce of her parents. She painted a picture for him of the years that followed, the droughts of loneliness when she was separated from her father, followed by the roaring floods of love and conflict when they came together again. You can see why I'm such a crazy, mixed-up kid, she told him, why I have to strive to be the best at whatever I do, and why I'm always drawn to try and protect the underdog. Half the time I'm still trying to win Papa's approval, while the other half of the time I'm trying to flout and reject his elitist, materialistic view of life. She snuggled against Sean. I truly don't know how you are going to handle me. Handling you will always be a pleasure, he assured her. But keeping you in your place looks like a full-time job. That's just the sort of thing that Papa would have said. You and I are in for some rip-roaring fights, mister. Ah, but just think of the reconciliations. What fun they will be. In the end, they managed a few hours of sleep and awoke surprisingly refreshed and clear-headed to take up the training where they'd left off at nightfall the previous day. When Claudia ran the last of the trainees through the attack sequences on the simulator, Sean and Job squatted beside the model of the gunship lager, and Sean explained his plans for the attack. Job listened attentively and made the occasional suggestion, until at last they had it all clear in their own minds. The approach march, the attack, and the withdrawal were the alternative actions to be taken if there were a hitch anywhere along the line. Okay, Sean stood up. Let's give it to the lads. The Shangani troopers watched totally absorbed from their perches on the rock slopes of the amphitheatre, while Sean and Job described the plans for the raid. They used river pebbles to denote the various units of the raiding party, moving them into place around the lager. When the attack began, Claudia manipulated her model hinds, and there were enthusiastic cheers from the watching Shanganis, as, one by one, they were brought crashing to earth by volleys of Stinger missiles. Right, Sergeant Alfonso, Sean replaced the counters in their original positions. Show us the attack again. 5 times they went over it. In turn, each of the section leaders described it to them, and the final cheers as the hinds were destroyed lost none of their gusto for being so often repeated. At the end of the 5th show, Sergeant Alfonso stood up and addressed Sean on behalf of the entire unit.
"Nkosi kakhulu," he began.
He had never before used this form of address to Sean. Usually this was reserved for very high-ranking tribal chieftains. Sean was aware of the honour, and this proof that he had at last won the full respect and loyalty of these fiercely proud and hard-bitten warriors.
"Great chief," Alfonso said, "your children are troubled."
There was a murmur of agreement, a nodding of heads.
"In all that you have told us of the battle, you have not assured us that you will be there to lead us and put fire in our bellies, as you did at Grand Reef. Tell your children, Nkosi kakhulu, that you will be with us in the midst of the fighting and that we will hear you roaring like a lion as the Henshaw fall, burning from the sky, and the Frelimo baboons run from us screaming like virgins, feeling the prong for the very first time."
Sean spread his hands.
"You are not my children," he said. "You are men of men, just as your fathers were men before you."
There was no higher compliment he could pay them.
"You do not need me to help you to do this thing. I have taught you all I know. The flames in your bellies burn with the same fury as the fire in the tall, dry grass of winter. The time has come for me to leave you. This battle is yours alone. I must go, but I will always be proud that we were friends and that we fought side by side as brothers do."
There was a low chorus of dissent, and they shook their heads and spoke together in low, rumbling tones. Sean turned away and saw that while he had been speaking, General China had come up and now stood quietly amongst the trees at the riverside watching him. There were a dozen officers and men of his personal bodyguard behind him, all wearing the same maroon berets, but somehow they seemed insignificant as China stepped forward and instantly commanded the attention of every person in the amphitheatre.